Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another edition of Reactor Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. Today we have another two-hour action-packed, fabulous show coming for you, to you today. Starting it off is going to be author and star of the TV show Dark Minds on the ID channel. Is going to be Mr. M. William Phelps. Next, we're going to have author DJ Nico, followed by New York Times bestselling author Eric Jerome Dickey. And then we're going to finish it off with author Cindy Cromer, and everybody's going to be talking about all of their stuff, a lot of things going on, more audio clips to be played book-wise, and some other things to talk about, and it all starts in a two-hour edition of Suspense Radio right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're going to like it.
Now, and I want to bring on our first guest, like I said, author extraordinaire, star of the show Dark Minds on the ID channel, good friend Mr. M. William Phelps. Matt, how you doing today? Thanks so much for joining us.
No problem, John. How are you?
Hey, you know, we are doing pretty good here, and I'm so glad to see, we were so excited because, you know, we knew you, of course, as being a fabulous true crime author. I'll remind everybody that your website is mwilliamphelps.com to find out everything that you do. And then we go ahead and we get this trailer in the mail from the ID station, Dark Minds, and lo and behold, look who's the star of the show, but none other than Mr. Phelps. And that was exciting. Got to know kind of how that all happened to get yourself with that show.
Well, it's a story that started about 4 or 5 years ago where I created a show, but I really didn't have the participants yet. I sketched out an idea that I had for a television show. I had several shows over the years in various stages of development, one for Court TV, another one for another network that, for whatever reason, got close to being made, but then they got canceled somehow. But
right.
this idea here, I have been working with a company called Beyond Productions, and they're out of Sydney, Australia, for 10 years as a crime expert for them, and they've done shows like Deadly Women, Poisonous Women. They did some old A&E work, I believe, and I was always one of their go-to experts. So I had a really good relationship with them, and my relationship was based on really the serial killer work that I had done. I had written 5 books or so at the time about serial killers. So I developed an idea of me just, a show about me doing what I do during the day, which is investigate crime and write about it and my passion for it. And then I met John Kelly about 4 years ago. Who, as you know, is on the show with me. He's a criminal profiler. And we started talking, and John started telling me about a serial killer that he corresponded with and then he spoke to once a week, and that he used as kind of an inside source on cases that John was working on unsolved serial killer cases. And immediately I said to myself, there I go. There's the hook for my show.
There it is.
Yeah, so I started to work on that pitch, and I pitched it to the production company that I knew and the producers that I knew. They loved it. And then we spent another year or so developing it and shooting what's called a sizzle. A sizzle in TV world is like a six-minute pilot, a pilot that you would call in Hollywood. In cable TV, you call it a sizzle. So you shoot like a six-minute version of the show. And so we got that done, and then they pitched it to Investigation Discovery, and it took forever to get it greenlit, but it finally did. And, you know, now I'm a producer on the show. I mean, a producer. I created it, and I star in it. So it's very exciting.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, it's definitely one of the most fascinating shows, not just from the fact of course, you are, you know, I love it when the both of you are sitting in the room with the phone in the middle and the serial killers on the other end. But the fascinating part is the in-depth detail, and let's just go with the Atlantic City show, where, of course, the show where you had the murders that happened in Atlantic City where they dumped them behind the hotel and there was, I think, four or five different bodies, and then they just stopped. But then, you know, you are on the ground, sitting there talking to the people who are there, witnessing it, having to live it, being frightened by it. And then you get the other side of somebody who did those terrible things to people. You're getting both views here in one place, and that's what I find the most fascinating part about the show.
Well, yeah, I mean, that for me, it's all about, like, my book work. The investigative work I do for my books, it's about being on the ground and talking to people. You know, I spend most of my days talking to people and getting their stories. And Dark Minds is no different. You know, I go down on the street. I go and visit the places where the crimes occurred. I try to talk to as many people as I can. And then I kind of bring this information to the serial killer, whom we call 13. Or I bring it to John, and John brings it to me, and we all discuss it. And, some of the stuff that 13 says, it just blows my mind. Because, and I want to say this, there's been some people say, well, he's saying stuff that we already know. He's saying stuff that you already know. You got to understand something about this guy. If me and you were talking, John, on this show, and we're talking about a serial killer case, and you give me some information about it, what you think, right, your personal opinion.
Right.
I'm not really going to take that personal opinion to the bank because, you know, you're an editor of a magazine, a great magazine. You do radio. But you haven't killed people. So when I talk to somebody who's actually done it and hunted people and preyed upon women and – you know, now we're putting it all into context. Now when he tells me something, it's not just some trite piece of information. This is, I take it to the bank, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and I guess the biggest thing that you'd have to overcome is people, of course, saying, well, there's no really number 13, and this is all staged and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, just from knowing you, knowing your work, knowing how everything you do, I would tell all those people literally that, you know, they're just stupid. I mean, I can't think of a better word, an idiotic, to realize that you are a consummate professional, that you bust your butt on doing everything that you can do, and bringing, I mean, and all this stuff is real. I mean, there's nothing, you know, of course you have to take different, you know, takes and whatnot, but the whole story, everything that goes into that show is 100% real and from your heart. And that's the great part about it. That's what you feel when you watch the show.
Oh, well, thank you for that. That's what it's very organic, the show. It's developing as I develop the cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't pay much mind to people who say that 13 is some contrived. I mean, I have a 20-something book reputation as a journalist,
right,
that I would never, ever put on the line to contrive some, like I said on The View, when they asked me if it was real or not, I said, look, what this is not is some stage wedding to a basketball player. You know,
yeah, exactly.
This is not the Kardashians. You know, this is real. I mean, it's 100% real, and you know, I don't know what else to say about it. I can tell you this: it's going to get a lot realer in the second season. So I don't think we'll be faced with any of those criticisms come season two.
Now here's something: the intrigue, of course, is not just the cases, but the number 13. You know, the number 13 guy. Have you met him in real life? Do you know the crimes that he committed? I mean, I know he did murders, but do you know the actual victims and his story of what he did?
Well, I can't answer the first part of that question, but I can tell you this. I can't really answer. See, there's certain things I can't answer mandated by certain people. But I can tell you this. I know what he's done. I know who he's done it to, how he's done it. I know all the details at this point.
Okay.
And believe me, this guy is a bona fide 1,000% psychopath who committed acts that are so vile and so evil that really I wouldn't even describe them to you that they're so vile. I mean, I wouldn't describe them on internet radio. I could get away with it, but I wouldn't describe
right.
them on air.
Okay. Well, and you know, and I guess are you picking cases, like Atlantic City and going forward? Are you picking cases like that you know will fall kind of into his specialty? I guess you want to say things that
no.
you know that he will know things about.
No, he has no part in the cases we pick. The cases that I choose. And I'm doing that as we speak. I've got the cases for the second season just about all bottled up here. But I choose cases that are close to my heart, cases that people have written in to me about over the years, not just since the show has aired, but over the years, cases that I've developed some contacts and sources and information about, and cases that I think can benefit from what I do. And then... After all of that, we decide, Kelly and myself decide, what information 13 will get. We don't give him everything. You see, that's why, too, some of what he says is so important because he didn't know it. Remember,
right.
he's in prison. He doesn't have access to the information that we do. He certainly doesn't have access to the information that I'm digging up while I'm out there investigating the case. So it all becomes, you know, what we want to give to him to see how smart he is. Or, you know, what we're after with 13 is to walk in the footsteps of the guy that I'm chasing. And
right.
and just to get some extra insight. And he's provided that.
Now, are you able to, when you're investigating and you're uncovering things and everything that's going on, do you then maybe bring new facts to unearth this cold case and maybe bring it back up to light that the police will then go ahead and further look at?
For example, episode 4 of Dark Minds in season 1 was the Worcester, Maine South murders
right.
in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
The Worcester County District's Attorney's Office subpoenaed my production company for an interview I did with someone on that show. So they certainly thought it was I did something worthy of their time to subpoena the interview. And again, I got a couple of hot tips from that show based on the information that I put out there, made sense to people. They wrote into me, and trust me, it was solid, solid information that will, when this case goes to court, end up in that courtroom.
And is that something that we're going to maybe see, maybe whether on the internet to have like, I don't know, an app or something to where it's kind of a follow-up to say, okay, you remember this episode? Well, here's what happened after the show transpired and things that came in and, you know, maybe try to answer some of the questions that weren't answered or things that are still going on. Do you guys have that kind of in development?
Yeah, I mean, when I got involved, let me just give you a little prologue first. When I got involved with publishing, I thought publishing moved slow. But let me tell you something about television. Molasses, all right? All right, so
So, I'm laughing because I know I live, you know, I live in Hollywood, and so I know exactly what you mean.
I mean, everything in the corporate world of television has to be checked out by 1,000 different people. So, yeah, right now, if you go on the investigationdiscovery.com/darkminds website, there's a link there for case updates. And when we give them to them, you know, they put them up at their leisure. There's a couple of updates up there now, I'm told. I haven't checked it in a while. But as the updates come in, you got to understand something. We all got to get together. I have to get together with my producers and a team of attorneys on both sides of the pond in Australia and in Washington where Discovery Channel is. And I have to get together with them. I have to submit the updates to them. They have to pick them apart. We have to question, you know, everything about the update. Is it going to hurt the case? Is it going to help the case? Are the cops cool with what we're going to do? You know, so there's a lot that goes into an update, and we've managed to do two so far, and as updates come in for the other cases and we're comfortable releasing information, we're going to let it out.
Well, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with Mr. M. William Phelps, star of the TV show Dark Minds on ID Station, and also author of your latest book, you know, that came out, I guess, what was it, Kill For Me, came out in September of 2010. Your website is mwilliamphelps.com. So kind of getting into your writing along with the show, you know, how has that kind of been able to kind of fit together? Have you seen something, you know, in your part of doing the show in cases that you're like, okay, this is going to make a book and you're going to end up turning it into one? Are you going to maybe put the two together? How are those things going to work out for your fans that are reading you also?
Oh, that's a good question. My latest book, incidentally, is Never See Them Again, came out in March. No problem. It's a Texas case. Right now I'm working on some books, and I have some books coming out this year that I worked on before Dark Minds, while Dark Minds was going. But what I'm doing now is exactly that. I'm trying to pick stories that are either directly or indirectly involved in the show, or at least the feel of the show, the subject of the show. I think you're going to see the two worlds merge in the next year or two. You're going to see both come together in one as a Dark Minds book, if you will, about one particular case and one particular person who will be introduced season two. Do I get scared?
Yeah, do you still get scared because your whole, you know, for the last 20-some years, your whole life has been wrapped around, you know, murder and all these things. Do you still get scared going into these kinds of things and reading about it and knowing it? I mean, does it still affect you emotionally that way?
Well, it affects me emotionally, but scared, no. I mean, a couple of times I was frightened while we were filming Dark Minds, and that was only because of where we were in the ghetto, and, you know, I really felt like we were going to be robbed, and we took off, like, you know, so that part, yes, that's a little scary. You know, if you've read my e-book that I wrote about the Atlantic City episode, the Eastbound Strangler, the e-book, you'll see that, you know, I almost got in a fight in Atlantic City with a guy who wanted to meddle with us. So, scared? No. Emotionally? Absolutely. And you know, and I want to say this too. If you watch the show and you see how dramatic, if you will, or emotional I am through it, you got to understand something. I'm on the road. I'm living that stuff 24/7. There's no break. We're up at the crack of dawn, 8 o'clock in the morning. We're out the door, the crew, and we don't get back to the hotel room till 10 o'clock at night. And then we're still working on stuff for the next day until we basically pass out. And then we're up again. And this is just goes on and on and on. So when I'm sitting in front of somebody interviewing them, and I got red eyes and I look like I'm about to cry, I mean, that's real, because I'm really feeling the case. You know, it's a couple of times filming the show, especially Atlantic City. And definitely Michigan, when I was up there. The darkness and the evil of this case was just weighing on my back so much that it literally felt like a weight I was carrying around, a weight.
Wow.
I just, it just literally was ripping me apart. And luckily, after both of those cases, we had a little bit of a break. So I get down south and I meet up with a couple of knuckleheads, you know, who you know, want to laugh at my hair because I got highlights in my hair, and they want to make fun of the way I talk. And I said, well, you know, that's all fucking good and that's fine.
Yeah.
But I'm here because there's 8 dead women. And if you want to make fun of me, fine. I don't care, as long as I can move the case forward to get some information out of you, you know? There's always drama on the road while we're filming. And, you know, I tell you, that's where some of the most important leads come from, while we're doing it, while we're filming.
Do you guys have any thoughts of doing something, I guess, like a really, like famous case, like the Zodiac Killer, like the Black Dahlia, things like that that were in the news for quite like some long time that have still never been solved, and kind of looking at them and putting them on the show? Or are you sticking more with, I guess, more of the more recent ones in the last 10 or so years and things like that, and, you know, maybe not so famous in that retrospect?
Yeah, I mean, there's a fine line between me. I have no interest in the Zodiac case. I mean, and the reason is just because it's just so, there's too much information about it out there. There's too many nut job. I mean, I even got involved with one nut job on that, and had to protect myself from that many years ago. But to answer your question specifically, I think one or two of the cases in season 2 people will definitely recognize. Of course, we're going to be doing the Long Island case. That's a guarantee. I mean, that we have to. And I have people on Long Island there now working for me who are developing information for me. So that's being worked as we speak. And a couple other of the cases you will recognize. They're not the infamous cases, but they will definitely be recognizable when you say, oh, yeah, that case. But we like to stay under the radars. We like to solve cases that, hey, they could be 5 years old or they could be 50 years old. That doesn't matter. What matters is, you know, can I develop any information about it that's really going to move it forward? I just don't want to rehash what everybody's done so far, you know?
I want to
use the show as a kind of means to further the case along. That's the objective. I mean, sure, it's dramatic, and we're making a television show. I get that too, but you know, I want to do some good with it. I mean, that's where my heart is.
You know, and it always questioned me, kind of, what made a case famous like Zodiac or Black Dahlia or things of those natures. And when you have other ones going on the same time, you know, and now you have like the Long Island one, then you have the Atlantic City, and those two kind of tied together in season 1. If people watch the show, you'll see a tie kind of in there. But is it the media that kind of picks this up and rolls with it and makes it more interesting? Because to me, a serial killer is a serial killer, and they all should be, whether it's more gruesome or not, I don't know, more scary. But I'm just trying to figure out, like, what makes it that kind of level? Do you have any idea?
Yeah. There's a good answer to that question, and it's a good question. And in fact, I was just talking to my serial killer source, not 13, but another one. We'll say, for the sake of the conversation, 14, last week about this. And what happens with some of these cases is there's a Hollywood sort of moment. Like, if you take the Long Island case, you had the killer call, supposedly call the mother of one of the victims on her own phone. So that's a Hollywood moment. The media grabs a hold of that, and they don't let go. You have the Zodiac sending these cryptic, you know, letters with, you know, charts, and, you know, it gets really Hollywoodish, cartoonish, and the media loves that. If you ever saw The Wire on HBO, I just finished watching all 60 episodes, not in one sitting, but, you know, over the course of several months. The final season of that show really, really exemplifies my point, because they create a serial killer, the cops, in order to fund some other work they're doing. And And the media doesn't pick up the case until there are bite marks on the victims. Now it becomes sexy, you know?
The killer
starts tying red ribbons, I'm talking about on the wire, around the wrists of the victims and leaving bite marks. Now the media just latches onto this. Now we got something, you know? So,
yeah,
your point is clear, and I agree with it, that any serial killer case, you know, it should get the same attention, but... You know, the other thing is cops don't really like a lot of attention for these because they don't really want to admit there's cases all over this country that should be called serial killer cases that aren't right now because the cops just don't want to come out and say it because, you know, they want to investigate it.
Well, I'm going to tell you what. I find not just the TV show, all of your work and everything that you've done with between your books, the show, all the investigative things, I mean – just so fascinating, so wonderfully written, so wonderfully produced and done that I just want to thank you so much for what you do and what you bring to us. I mean, we blew through this 25 minutes like it was 2 minutes. I just can't believe it. I mean, we could have gone on for hours talking about that, which is something I would love to do and have you back on maybe when show, you know, episode or season 2 starts coming out and things like that and maybe get, you know, things that are going on.
Sure, sure, Jen. I appreciate the time and the interesting conversation. It was fun.
Well, I try to make it interesting, Matt. Sometimes I'm kind of boring.
No. I was just flipping through the new issue of the magazine. It looks really, really exciting.
Yeah, I sent that out this morning to you, so there you go.
Yeah. Right. But, hey, thank you, all right?
Well, Matt, thank you, and I will talk with you soon, and you have a great one, and enjoy yourself. If you can out there with all those freaking psychos.
Hey, good luck with the show. Take care.
All right, man. Have a good one. Thanks a lot. All right, everybody. That was, again, Mr. M. William Phelps, star of Dark Minds, writer extraordinaire of numerous true crime books. Go to mwilliamphelps.com to find out more information. You can also like Dark Minds on Facebook. Mr. Phelps is on Facebook. You know, there's a lot of places to find him out, and I just want to thank him so much for coming on. We are going to be hitting here with our next guest, DJ Nico, in just a second. Right now, we're going to play our first audio clip of the day. It's Necessary Extremes. It's by David Salkin, and then we will be right back.
This is from Necessary Extremes by David M. Salkin. Imam Ayatollah Kamala could be heard over loudspeakers for many blocks, and his followers hung on every syllable. He had finished with the traditional prayers and went on with his morning's tirade against the West, Israel, and the great Satan. If they only knew. But how could they? How could the tens of thousands of Islamic fundamentalists who followed preaching of Imam Ayatollah Kamala, one of Iran's most violent mullahs, possibly contemplate the notion that this man had actually been funneling information to the Americans for over 25 years? He was everything an Islamic fundamentalist was supposed to be. How could his followers possibly know that Imam Ayatollah Kamala had actually been born by Jean Mujerov, a Western-educated intellect who had been present during the sacking of the U.S. Embassy some 27 years earlier? Bijan, who had seen his parents killed during the revolution that removed the Shah from Iran and changed his country forever. For the first few months after the revolution, Bijan and his brothers hid, going from place to place with any family members or friends who would help them. They were eventually turned in, and Bijan escaped only moments before his cousin's house was searched, and his cousins and brothers were taken away to some medieval prison to be tortured to death in the name of Islam. It was at that time that Bijan, now alone in the world, decided that his life's purpose was to save his beloved country and avenge the deaths of his entire family. Bijan's life changed forever when he was introduced to an American secret agent named Michael Skripak. Skripak, who had been somewhat unofficially attached to the embassy, had been stuck in Iran after the embassy fell. Bijan had been a scholar as a young man and harbored no ill will against the Jews, the Americans, or the West in general. It had been his dream to one day live in America, and in fact, a professor whom he had corresponded with at Princeton University was a Jew. To be speaking such contemptuous and hateful ramblings about the Jews and infidels left a bad taste in his mouth, and he was only able to be believable by overacting and going over the top in his speeches. The irony was that the more he lied and made up history, the more he was believed.
Glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fast. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stine, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, Ann Rule, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
So I want to welcome everybody for coming back. Again, I want to welcome Mr. M. William Phelps, again, star of Dark Minds, the TV show on ID, and author extraordinaire for being our guest on there. You just listened to Necessary Extremes by David Salkin. You can go out and find more information about him. You can search David Salkin, S-A-L-K-I-N, to find out information about his stuff and everything that he's going on with. If you want to hear your book on the air, your audio clip, all you have to do is email editor@suspensemagazine.com. I'll tell you everything what to do. It's very simple, very easy, and most of all, it's free. I just want to help you sell your book. So it's free. Just send it to me. We'll play it on a show coming up, and I'm telling you what, if you don't know what shows are coming up, you know, we have Nick Santora, we have Steve Barry coming up. We have Eric Jerome Dickey coming up just today after, you know, Miss DJ Nico. So we have so many great people coming up on the show. Get your book out there and let people listen to it. So right now I want to go ahead and bring on our next guest, which is author DJ Nico. And the website is DJNIKObooks.com, talking about her latest release, The Tenth Saint, which is the first and a new series of archaeological thrillers, and it's featuring her character, Sarah Weston. So, DJ, I want to thank you so much for coming on, and how are you doing?
I'm doing just great. Thank you for having me today.
So, again, The Tenth Saint, your first in a new series of archaeological, it's so early here, I guess.
Archaeological.
I just can't. I'm probably needing too many Three Musketeers, I guess. And so, tell everybody a little bit about The Tenth Saint, you know, why you decided to kind of do a series and your character, Sarah, and kind of how everything's wrapping up with them.
Okay, wonderful. First of all, like you said, The Tenth Saint is book one in a series called The Sarah Weston Chronicles. And it's also my debut novel, which I'm also very excited about. It released in March of this year. And, so far it's been pretty well received. So, I'm very excited to be on your show and share that with your listeners. So, really, the Tenth Saint was kind of born out of a few different things. First of all, you know, they always say, write what you know, write what you love, and it kind of brings together a lot of passions of mine. I've always had a passion for the ancient world and for history in general, but especially ancient history. I'm Greek originally, and mm-hmm. I think, you know, a love for the ancient world is kind of in our DNA. That's just long been an interest and, even a course of study for me. The other thing is I've always been a traveler and specifically an adventure traveler, just personally and professionally. I used to be a travel writer for many years, and I've been to some parts of the world that, you know, many people don't even know are on a map. And so, I've had some, you know, adventures and some misadventures as well, and met a lot of interesting characters along the way, and had all kinds of interesting events, you know, good, bad, and everything in between happened to me while I was out on the road. And, a lot of it was done, as I said, for professional purposes, but a lot of it was sort of filed away as well for whatever reason, and I think a lot of it ended up kind of gelling as I decided to sit down and write fiction. So And another passion I have also is the environment and, you know, our, the preservation of our planet and all of that. So I think if you've read the book, you've probably noticed that all those three things come together. It is, as you mentioned earlier, an archaeological thriller. So everything is based on, you know, my character, Sarah Weston, who is a British archaeologist. She's affiliated with Cambridge University, and she's on a dig in Ethiopia in a northern highland city called Aksum, which has a really long and illustrious history as a major trade center and the seat of an empire back in the early centuries of the Common Era. It was actually, Ethiopia was called Abyssinia at the time and was a very important you know, part of a very important trade route sort of between North Africa and Arabia. You know, as you know, it was on the crossroads, just on the edges of the Red Sea. So it has a, you know, huge history. And now, of course, in present day Ethiopia, it's just a kind of a shadow of its former self, with poverty and, you know, economic challenges and so on. But it still, you know, remains a fascinating place nonetheless. So Sarah is on a dig in Ethiopia and just sort of comes across an unexpected find, which is the tomb of an unknown man inside a cave, and there are some inscriptions in an obscure language just carved into the cave wall. And this kind of takes her on a little bit of a journey, because she, of course, she's intrigued because she's very curious by nature, and she's also a little bit of a maverick by nature. She's born an aristocrat, but she sort of wants to really escape that world and really have something a little bit more substantial in her life, and really make a difference. And so, you know, the more she looks into this find, the more convinced she is that it's something significant. And, you know, she goes on this journey to translate the inscriptions. And, of course, it becomes a very perilous journey because as much as she wants to find out what it all means, there are various entities who want to keep it under wraps. And, of course, she comes, you know, head-to-head with this enemy, this, you know, faceless enemy, if you will, because she doesn't even know who she's fighting against and why. But her journey is very much an adventure through Ethiopia, through, you know, various cities of Europe and, you know, wherever, you know, the clues of the mystery take her. But it's also a little bit of a personal journey as well, you know, sort of a story about how she finds, you know, ultimately finds her identity and, you know, is able to, you know, really make a difference in the sense that she brings to the world something that is a very significant find that a lot of people, you know, warn her against and, you know, and a lot of people fight her for. So, you know, that's a little bit of, you know, kind of the background of the story. Of course, it's a lot more complicated than that because it also brings in a parallel subplot, which is the story of the 10th saint himself. The 10th saint, of course, being the man who is entombed, you know, the subject of her find in Ethiopia. But I have a historic subplot that kind of tells his story, and that the two plots sort of meet, I'd say, about halfway through the book, and then some revelations are made in regards to, you know, to the inscriptions on the wall and what they mean.
Now, whenever, you know, you're writing here, and I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with author DJ Niko, and it's DJ Niko, NIKObooks.com, talking about The Tenth Fate, which is her debut novel, and the first, which is now going to be in a series of her character, Sarah Weston. So you're setting in Ethiopia, and whenever you write historical fiction and historical, you know, books like this, the first thing that people always want to know is what's real and what you made up. Now, do you want to put that? Now, do you? What can you kind of tell us about what is real and kind of what it, and what the fictional part of it is, along with your book, so people kind of have the understanding when they kind of go into it that they know, oh, well, this part is here, well, this part was kind of, you know, added to make it sound good.
Right, right, exactly. You know, I guess I should say right off the bat is, you know, of course it's fiction. So if few of the things are you know, invented for the purpose of telling the story, but it is very much based on history. The descriptions of Ethiopia, and of course Sarah's plot is in the present day, but the descriptions of modern day Ethiopia are all accurate because it's written from personal experience. I've spent time in Ethiopia. I've been to the places I write about, and you know, have met loads of characters who actually inspired and informed my characters. So you know, any of the descriptions you see of, let's say, Lalibela, which is the city also up in the mountains, the holy city that was built in the 12th century by an Ethiopian king, and there are the churches that are carved into the rock. I mean, like literally carved into the rock. This place exists, okay, and it's a very real place, and the descriptions are very accurate. The subplot, which is historic, that's written in the 4th century, and it takes place in the Syro-Arabian desert in a tribe of Bedouins. The Bedouin customs and the descriptions of Bedouin life, also very accurate, again, because they're written from personal experience. Now, of course, I didn't experience it in the 4th century, but you know, I was able to go on current knowledge that I have of the Bedouins and of desert life in general, and sort of you know, research the past and how you know, they used to live back then. So all those descriptions are accurate as well. There is a ton of information on Coptic Christianity, because it's kind of central to the plot of the book, because Sarah ends up spending a lot of time in monasteries and whatnot. So the descriptions of Coptic Christianity are in Ethiopian Orthodoxy and monastic life, all those are accurate as well. There were 9 saints in Ethiopia who spread Christianity and built the monasteries that you know, still exist to this day. There was no 10th saint. Okay, that part is a production of my imagination. But the king Azana, who appears in the historical plot, who actually named this man the 10th saint, it literally would have been the first saint of Ethiopia, because the 9 other saints didn't even exist at the time. But the king who sanctified him was real. The battles he fought were real. You know, so all those descriptions are actually very accurate. It's just the 10th saint who is, the fictional character, and, takes a lot of the history and just kind of takes it one step further. The other thing that's fictional is a description of the subterranean library that Sarah and her colleague Daniel Madigan go through to find the codex. It's fictional, but it's also based on a subterranean network of tunnels that connects the churches in Lalibela. So there is, you know, this sort of subterranean network, that is fact, but I kind of based my description of the subterranean library on, what I know about those tunnels, but it is, a fictional place, and, that's something that obviously I needed to invent in order for them to get underneath the Holy of Holies in this monastery. So, so that part is invented as well, and also the labyrinth that I describe. The church itself that the labyrinth is in is real, but the labyrinth and the subterranean library are false. So, but I'd say, I guess you could tell just from my descriptions now that about, 80% of the book is based on actual history and, actual people from history.
Now, seeing as I think that that's fascinating, because you're able to take all of those real things and you're putting them into those kind of fictional, fictional plot, but it's kind of like you're using all real world items and real world, myths and legends and things like that with people, and you're able to wrap it up into a fictional thing. And I always find that's very fascinating. And this is your debut book. So did you create the plot and know what you wanted to write about first? Because this is not something that you just did overnight. When you're writing a historical thriller as in-depth as yours is, this is going to take some time. So were you thinking of, I have a plot and this is kind of what I want to focus on, I want to do this? or were you like, I really want to write this character, Sarah Weston, and now what kind of story can I put it in? And then you kind of thought it that way. So it's always kind of the chicken or the egg. Which kind of came first?
Well, you know, it was a story, actually, and the character was actually born after I got the story in my mind. You know, I just kind of want to address the point you made earlier about how complicated the story is and how in-depth it is. There is a ton of research that has gone into this book. It took me 4 years to write it.
Four years.
You know, largely,
wow.
Yeah, four years. I mean, I wasn't doing it full time at the same time, but I was working on it very regularly. But it took 4 years, largely because of the huge amount of research that went into it. And you know, in addition to all the historical elements and the descriptions of the places, which you know, I always insist on experiencing, you know, every place I write about myself. If there's a place that I want to write about that I haven't been to, you know, I will make it a point to go. But you know, in general, because I've been to so many places through my journalism career, I you know, also have kind of a frame of reference already kind of built into my brain, you know, that I draw upon. But my background as a journalist, I think, is a very important point to make, because you know, research kind of comes you know, naturally to us, and and it's also like really fun. That's kind of one of the funnest parts of being a journalist. And so that kind of went hand in hand, and it was just kind of a natural progression. I wanted to tell, you know, this story. I wanted to put Ethiopia in print because it's a place that has long fascinated me. And I wanted to also make the environmental point. I haven't talked so much about this one just yet, but you know, at the heart of the book is you know, it's almost like this cautionary tale about man's interference in the environment, and and it talks a little bit about you know, the prophecies. The Ten Saints prophecies are actually you know, a warning about the destruction that we're bringing forth on the planet, and what is what this destruction pivots on is the introduction of algae into the oceans in order to capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and convert it into pure oxygen, thereby mitigating global warming, which, of course, you know, we all know global warming is a problem. The more, you know, the more time that passes, the more of a problem it becomes. And the research out there, you know, that sort of confirms that is pretty staggering. And so, you know, I just kind of wanted to take a what-if scenario based on this, you know, algae theory. And I should also say here that a lot of the algae theory is also based on fact, because, you know, I think a lot of us know that algae is used as biofuel, or is being, you know, sort of captured to produce biofuel, but not a lot of people know that it's used for carbon capture, at least in an experimentative way. And there are universities right now that have this kind of technology, that are doing this kind of research, where they're cultivating algae in these huge bioreactors, where they're growing them on sheets through photosynthesis, so that flue gases can sort of pass over these sheets, and you know, the algae then captures the carbon and converts it into oxygen and nitrogen, and you know, things like this. So it's a technology that exists. So, you know, that's another thing that fascinated me. But because of the fact that algae is you know, unstable, and the fact that, I mean, there are actually a lot of reasons why it hasn't been you know, released into the mainstream. But one of the biggest reasons is the instability of algae. So I just kind of went off of all of this research that does exist and just did you know, what-if scenario, like what happens if, you know, all of a sudden, instead of growing them on bioreactors and ponds, which is what's happening today, you know, what if we take them onto the oceans because, you know, we need more space, we need more algae, and what if there's, you know, a situation where there's a nuclear accident and the runoff kind of causes the algae to mutate and to grow exponentially, and, you know, what would happen then? And so, you know, by consulting scientists, And, you know, doing my own research, I, you know, put forth kind of this, you know, destructive apocalyptic scenario, and that is what the 10th Saint's prophecy is, and that is what Sarah actually tries to prevent from happening in the present day, because there are signs that she sees and, you know, material that she reads that, you know, tells her that this technology is happening now, and, you know, if it goes to the next stage of approval, it could be really pretty deadly on the planet. So this is the journey she goes on, and it's you know, really kind of fascinating. I don't know if I answered your question. I think I went off on three tangents.
And what you did was that you also kind of, you know, you gave a little bit about more, you know, everything that's going on, because, you know, your book is very, I mean, it's very in-depth, and it covers, you know, a wide range of kind of things. And when you're taking the reader through, you know, you're not only, you're taking them through kind of a tunnel with a light at the end of the tunnel, but then you have little tunnels on the side that come in, and people and things. And it just makes, and that's what a thriller, that's what historical fiction, that's what these things, and that's what these books are. And that's why fans mm-hmm. go crazy for them when they're reading them. And when you all, and now the one thing, of course, you know you're going to get asked, and I'm going to ask it, is when you say this is the first book in a series, mm-hmm. how long is the series? Do you have an end? Is there an open end? Is there something that you already have planned out with Sarah ahead of time when you said, hey, I'm going to make this a series? Or is it literally something that, you know, you're going to keep writing Sarah, but there's no end in sight?
Well, John, you know, I think I didn't write it in the beginning as a series. I was just kind of writing the book. But, you know, the more I went along, the more I thought, you know, this is sort of, you know, it could be endless, because, you know, there are so many adventures an archaeologist can have. I mean, there are so many archaeological digs in the world, all of them fascinating for their own reasons. You know, I could sort of have her go from this place to that place to that place, sort of exploring not only ancient history, but also real life issues that impact the modern day, because I really do believe that the past totally ties into the present and ties into, you know, help us define our future. And so, you know, all of these sort of like this continuum of past, present, and future is just so fascinating to me. And, you know, no matter, you know, what archaeological digs she could be on, you know, there could be some sort of revelation about, you know, who we are now and who, you know, how our planet could evolve in the future. And so I thought, okay, well, at the end, I sort of left it open-ended. And then my publisher actually came to me and said, you know, what are you working on next, you know, for this character? And so that's when the second idea got developed, and that's going to, my second book is actually going to release in June 2013. You know, the series is open-ended. I wouldn't say it's like a three-part series, four-part series or anything like that. Right now the second book is, you know, almost finished, but you know, there will be hopefully a third and more after that, as long as people are willing to read them. And, you know, there's a, sort of a, an audience for it out there. I'll keep writing them.
So I want to remind everybody again, we are speaking with author DJ Nico, and her website is djnicobooks.com, N-I-K-O. The book is The 10th Saint. And so kind of a little bit off subject, mm-hmm. just to kind of, you know, a little bit of different kinds of things, is if there was one, I guess, it could be a dig, it could be anything, one thing that has eluded man to be a mystery to figure out, what would you want to go ahead and solve for yourself to be able to say that that mystery you could solve, whether it's a Stonehenge or something to that, to know the mystery behind what is out there, whether it's Atlantis or anything, what would you want to solve for yourself as personal?
Awesome. I love that question. And it actually really ties into my second book, which is really convenient. So,
The Riddle of Solomon coming out June 2013. Okay, go ahead.
Exactly. So, you know, the mystery that I'm very fascinated about, and the reason why I wrote the Riddle of Solomon to begin with, is the mystery of King Solomon. As no doubt know, there has been so much written and spoken and, you know, invented, really. I mean, like from you know, the biblical words to the legends about King Solomon. I mean, everybody in the world practically knows who King Solomon was. And yet there has been so little found, you know, that even proves that he was a real character in history. I mean, you know,
was it the Michael Crichton book, Congo, where it was King Solomon's mines and that's what they were going to go look for and things like that? I think that was the basis of his book.
Right, yeah, it was one of the Crichton books, and you know what, I don't know if it was Congo. I read Congo, and I don't recall that, but of course it was so long ago, and, you know, I don't know. But, yeah, absolutely, King Solomon's mines being the copper mines, of course, that he actually supposedly got all the copper to build the Temple of Jerusalem with. That would be the first temple. You know, the mines have not really been found. I mean, there have been lots of mines found in, let's say, in Timna, in Kirbat, in Nahas, that sort of, you know, the theory says that these were King Solomon's mines. Nobody really knows, okay? And because of the fact that Temple Mount has been built over and now sort of, you know, is a Muslim site with a mosque on top of it. You know, what lies beneath, nobody will ever know. And of course, Solomon's temple was burnt to the ground by the Babylonians. So nothing has really been found from the first temple. I mean, all of the you know, the items that are listed in the Bible and in the Kabbalah and the Quran. I mean, everything, every piece of sort of religious literature mentions this man and his legendary empire. I mean, he was one of the wealthiest kings of the time, and you know, there's so little out there. I would love to solve that mystery, and I definitely unpack it in the second book. So,
well, I want to tell you what. I want to thank you so much for coming on, DJ. We've run out of time. We have been flying through this. And I just want to tell everybody, recommend to go read The Tenth Saint. DJNicoBooks.com, again, is the website. The book is The Tenth Saint. And DJ, thank you again so much for coming on, and we look forward to June 2013 and Solomon.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been fun for me.
Thank you, and you have a great day, and we will talk with you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that was author DJ Nico, DJNicoBooks.com, N-I-K-O. Find out about the 10th Saint and everything that she has going on. A lot of fascinating stuff. We are going to be right back. We're going to play our next audio clip right now called Thin Blood by author Vicki Tiley. Vicki's done a lot of wonderful stuff. And so then we're going to be back on with our next guest, New York Times bestselling author of his latest book, An Accidental Affair, Eric Jerome Dickey. So here we go with Thin Blood.
Crossroad Press and Springbrook Audio present a PerfectVoices.net production of Thin Blood by Vicki Tiley, read by Basil Sands. Thin Blood. The ties that bind us are not always of blood. Prologue. Craig Edmonds stared at hands sticky with darkening blood. His hands. He held them away from his body and looked down at his chest in horror. Large, dirty red blotches marred the once pristine white shirt. Forgetting the blood on his hands, he tore at the buttons, ripping the shirt open. Breathing in short, sharp gasps, he frantically examined his torso, looking for the wound. No cuts, no injuries, no holes where there shouldn't be any. His chest heaved in relief. He wasn't dying after all. But then, mid-sigh, it struck him. If it wasn't his blood, whose was it? His head whipped around, his eyes scanning the room like radar on overdrive. Even in the half-light, he quickly saw all was not as it should be. The glass shade from one of the bedside lamps lay in shattered fragments on the floor. The curtain rail over the bedroom's bay window hung at a precarious angle. Usually a black-and-white photo of a nude, tattooed woman hung above the bed. Now the frame lay in pieces in the doorway. He focused on the queen-sized bed, his stomach clenched as he took in the twisted and disheveled bedclothes. Instinctively, he knew the dark patches on the sheets weren't shadows that would disappear once the curtains were opened. He swallowed the acrid morning aftertaste of whiskey harsh in his parched mouth.
"Kirsty,"
he croaked. Clearing his throat, he called again, hesitant but louder. In the crushing silence, time stood still. "Kirsty!" he screamed, as he dashed into the master bedroom's compact white-tiled ensuite. He stumbled, clutching at the doorframe. He took in the bloodied handprints adorning the vanity unit and walls, like some sort of macabre finger painting. Fighting an intense wave of nausea, he looked down at the blood-smeared floor. Trying desperately to rein in his growing panic, he raced to the main bathroom. His wife wasn't there either. Next room. Out of breath, heart hammering, he reached the internal door that led to the double garage and opened it. The external roller door was down, and his red Alfa Romeo and Kirsty's silver Lexus were parked next to each other. Gripping the door handle, he sagged against the door. He took a deep breath, fought for control of his adrenaline-charged body. He lurched into the kitchen, heading for the sink. Hands shaking violently, he somehow managed to turn on the cold water tap. He watched, mesmerized, as the blood from his hands, diluted by water, swirled in a pink eddy in the bottom of the sink before disappearing down the plug hole. Oblivious to the water dripping from his hands, he dropped onto the pine storage box-cum bench beneath the window at the edge of the kitchen. Elbows on knees, he dropped his forehead into his hands. If only the infernal pounding would let up, he could think straight. His memory of the previous evening was patchy, to say the least. He had a vague recollection of arriving home, stressed after a late-night meeting at the office, and, bypassing the dried-out dinner Kirsty had kept warm for him, heading for the bottle of Chivas Regal. After that, it was anyone's guess as to what had happened. A series of short clips flashed through his mind. In one, he saw himself shouting at Kirsty, her throwing up her hands and yelling back. What had they been arguing about? In another, he was picking up his car keys and, "Damn it, why can't I remember?" he thought, glancing towards the door leading into the garage. It was then he saw the set of four smudged, rust-brown streaks low on the door frame. He closed his eyes, praying for the nightmare to end, except he had a feeling the nightmare was only beginning.
So, again, everybody, I want to thank you back. That was Thin Blood by Vicky Tiley. And you can find out more information on Vicky by going and finding out her information. Vicky Tiley, Google. I think it's VickyTiley.com, but I'm not exactly sure. I want to thank M. William Phelps for joining us earlier, the host of Dark Minds and author extraordinaire. Go check out him at mwilliamphelps.com. And then we just had DJ Nico on and talked about her book. But right now, we want to bring back a friend of ours, New York Times bestselling author, Eric Jerome Dickey. We had him on with his last book. He's back now, off tour. I believe he's off tour. I don't know. The guy tours so much. I mean, he's like a rock star. Yeah. And an accidental affair. So, Eric, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. No complaints on this thing. Everything is wonderful.
Yeah, like we said. So you're back here, accidental affair. We had you on last year with your last book, which was Tempted by Trouble.
Yeah.
And so how's everything been going? I see that they kind of put you, they kind of moved you from a fall more back into the spring. And I think the last time that they had you as a spring release was back in Pleasure, back in like 2008.
Probably was, yeah. Well, you know, because I had been doing pretty much about three books every 2 years in a two-year span. And I kind of slowed down a bit last year. Intentionally, because I was, you know, you start, you know, just super workaholic. You're neglecting everything in the real world, and you just gotta, you know, just need to be home for a bit. But
right.
But outside of that, it was just, I mean, the book was probably finished 6-7 months ago.
Wow.
So they just sort of took their time about putting me out on tour, which was cool for me. I mean, I've been cranking out books since 96, not at a James Patterson pace, but there was one period where I had three books in 18 months. And,
man.
Yeah, you know, and you just, you know, and 20 years later, well, 15, 16 years later, it's like, all right, let me have a summer to myself.
Right.
You know.
Have a nice summer off, relax.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know what, Rice? We never really stop. I mean, you know, the only thing that happens is a deadline shift. That's about it. Because you know we're working, and I think like I think starting out, you always want to be ahead, so far as turning in your manuscripts. But at some point, you get stuff completed, and they move dates up. You know, they move dates up. So that's what happened early in my career, when say like I had two books done. And I'm thinking the next book is going to come out, you know, next year. Then it came out in 7 months, you know.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, without a doubt. But, you know, but you're one of the best people to ask this question to also is that now with the resurgence, or not the resurgence, but, I mean, the e-book revolution that's going on, and you are constantly writing, when are we going to see, like, a little novella or short story kind of thing that you're just going to produce on your own and put out there in e-book form?
You know what, I've been thinking about that because I've got a couple of things around that I could definitely refine and do that. And I had a conversation with someone within the last 6 weeks. We were actually talking about that. You know, it's,
I mean, don't tell me that you don't get emails from your fans talking about some of your characters and some of your older books.
Yeah.
That they would love to see you maybe expand on or maybe tell a little prequel or do a little bit of after thing or something that you can kind of go ahead and do.
You do, and you can do it in that form. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be a 70,000-word project. You know what I mean? You can do something shorter, something, and, you know, and the fans would definitely appreciate it, you know?
Yeah, 40, 50 pages, 99 cents, put it out there. I mean, it would be, people would love it. They would love to see that because what that does is that it makes you more of an interactive author knowing that, I do read my fan stuff and I knew that they want this done, so I want to go ahead and do more.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I've definitely thought about it. And also, I have other standalone pieces that I would love to do that with, and I'll probably investigate it and probably actually end up doing that within the next year or so.
Yeah, I mean, and the good thing is, and I know publishers don't want to hear this, but you can do it on your own.
I know. I mean, I think it's probably, the internet has done this thing, with, especially, you know, with e-books. You know, the middleman has been cut out. You know,
absolutely. Absolutely,
I mean,
it has.
Totally been cut out. I mean, so it's totally changed the way people do business or... Well, it's like no longer have to get an agent, have to get accepted by an agent, have to go through the rejections at the publishing company. It's just you can write and put it out there and see what happens, you know. 50 Shades of Grey, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, that's it. I mean, and it's funny because a lot of these projects that are just totally blowing up are stuff that people would have rejected.
Yeah.
You know, it just wouldn't have sold because... Because I think a lot of times, a lot of people, they do the same old, and when something different comes, and they don't know what to do with it, so they don't even try to market it, they don't have to sell it. But now with Facebook, Twitter, the word of mouth on the internet is just crazy, you know, repost, retweet. You know, it's possible for everybody to build a fan base, to have an audience. Well, even years ago, before I got to this point, the author Zane had a huge following online before she ever published a book. So she had so she had tens of thousands of people waiting for the novel to come out. And so 2, 3, 4 years later, by the time a novel hit, you know, it was phenomenal. They were waiting for it. They were waiting for the novel the way the Hunger Games fans are waiting for the movie.
Exactly. That's what they were doing.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'll remind everybody, we're speaking here with Eric Jerome Dickey. Latest book is An Accidental Affair, ericjeromedickey.com. And, you know, just from your last book, Tempted by Trouble, which was in August 2010 until now, so basically a year and a half later, the publishing world has just changed again for you. So right when you thought that you were kind of getting into the mold, all of a sudden it's all different.
Oh, it's totally different. I think my e-book sales went up times five.
Exactly.
Just, you know, over a year. You're like, wow, you know. And right now you get that mixture of people who show up, they have Kindles, and they find a way for you to sign the Kindle, the cover or something like that, to people who will download it on Kindle and still buy the hardcover.
Right.
So you know what I mean? So it's because a lot of people, they still want signed books. but the only difference now is they get the book signed, they put it on the shelf, and they're reading it on the Kindle. They're not even breaking the spines on the books.
Yeah, so, I mean, and do you think, and that's a good point, because I'm a comic book collector.
Yeah.
And I buy hardcover comics, but I never open them. I just download them digitally so I can read them.
Right,
and I wonder,
you don't want to break the spine. It's
I don't want to break it.
Yeah.
That's right, because that'll kill it right away.
Well, because once the spine is broken, it's like a car with a used engine, you know.
It is.
It's not quite worth it. It's got too many miles on it already, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
You're definitely seeing that. You're seeing that shift. And I had told someone 2-3 years ago, because I came from software development. My degree is in computer systems technology, and I was telling people, I was like, you know, it's going to shift. I was like, it's where everyone has a laptop, everyone has a cell phone that's capable of downloading. I said, people are just going to it's just easier. And I said, well, people aren't, they're not. I said, yes, they are, because your generation may not, but the next generation is coming up, computers in the school, iPad in the school, e-readers in the school. That's the way they're going to do business.
Well, when you just had Apple and Barnes & Noble and Microsoft and Google and all these people now getting together, and what's their next big venture? Textbooks.
Yeah.
You're going to see college bookstores, so it's all textbooks. So now you're going to start seeing all that in colleges, and that's the way the future is going to go. And, yeah, people my generation were used to picking up books, but I love e-books. I love it electronically. I could put 3,000 books in one little freaking device. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Well, and then, and for me, for someone who travels a lot, I no longer have to carry.
Yeah, for you.
You know, because I said, like, I went to Argentina about 5-6 years ago, and I was going to be gone for 3 months. And it's funny because, you know, I'm trying to take all the books that I can take with me, because when I get to Argentina, I'm not going to be able to find books in English. You know, that's my,
exactly.
Right. So it's like, I don't have to do that. I don't have to do it anymore. It's on my iPad. I can get to Argentina. I can download when I get to Argentina. You know, and it's just that. And then also, I'll tell somebody this, is like, and now your books are part of your luggage, and now they want to charge you $30 for another bag, $50 for another bag, $100 for another bag. You don't have to worry about that anymore.
Nope.
I mean,
for
me.
It's just the convenience factor is just unquestioned, and
they'll start
realizing that. You know, get over the fact, and I need to tell people, you know, and I tell them all the time, get over the fact that you don't have the flipping book in your hand and you're turning the pages, because I guarantee you that your book, An Accidental Affair, is the same in hardcover as it is electronic. You get the same thing.
Well, the devices have it now, so you can.
I just think you get
bookmark,
more royalty on the hardcover.
You can write in the margins. You can do all this neat stuff that is just like, wow, man.
Also this.
The devices have dictionaries. So
as you're reading,
you can just tap on the word, boom, there's a definition.
Yeah. So now you can be a little bit more, thesaurus, because then people can say, what is he writing about? Oh, that's what he meant to say.
That has shifted too, because now as readers read, and I know they did it with Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, they're reading the book. They're in front of their laptop, and they're Googling stuff that he's talking about.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's what people do. I mean, so you mention something. You mention a place. You mention a recipe. You mention a particular pair of shoes. There's someone
in the book. You click right out to the Internet and understand what he's talking about right away.
That's it. I mean, but because and also they're visual. It's like if I'm describing something and it's real – they want to click it. They want to look at it. Okay, so this is what she's wearing. Oh, this is the car he's driving. Oh, this is the city he's in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
From that
perspective, I've seen it shift. I've seen it change. The readers are always going to be there. It's just where are they going to get their materials from?
That's the thing. And there's going to be, you know, and I think there's going to be more readers. I mean, with the addition of, more tablets being sold and more things being sold, you're going to see more e-books being sold. And I don't know. I think it's a great thing, but
I guess the older generation doesn't like it.
Well,
because now you can download stuff in areas that don't have bookstores. You know, some areas, I mean, you know, if there is a bookstore and they don't have it, you can download it.
Yeah.
I guarantee you, hardcover 50 Shades of Grey, I mentioned that again, it's just totally sold out. So it's forced people to go back and download more.
Yep. And they, and you know what? The download never runs out.
Never runs out. Never
it is there forever.
Oh, and also, I know this is becoming like real technical, but you know, I use all Apple products. So if I'm reading something on my iPad or my iPhone, it automatically goes
That's
to the
right.
last page read.
That's right. You can transfer between devices, and it just keeps up with it.
Yeah, it just keeps up with it. You know, it just goes to the last page read. So as I move from, you know, if I'm doing the iPad, if I close it down, if I'm on the plane, I decide I want to read a little bit, I just take out my phone. It's right there, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, so, again, this is Eric Jerome Dickey. His book is Accidental Affair. We've been talking about really everything except what's in your book. And that's fine with me. But
that's
why don't you kind of, you know, but, you know, go ahead and tell everybody a little bit about, you know, your character, you know, James Thicke.
Yeah.
You know, you wrote the thriller. You got the whole thing going on. You know, give a little bit about, you know, what's happening in the book. Because, you know, you fans out there, because we know you have stalker fans. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, they kind of like want to know all this kind of fun stuff.
Yeah.
Even though, you know.
Yeah, with the book Accidental Affair, main character James Thicke is said the number one screenwriter in Hollywood, meaning everyone in Hollywood would know him. But outside of the business, you know, when we go to movies, we never really know who writes the movie. I mean, people don't stick around outside of Hollywood going to a premiere where everyone gets applauded from the screenwriter to the actors to the best boy. You know,
yeah.
And he's married to Regina Thicke, who is the number one actress in the world. And under the pressures of Hollywood, she's on a project, has to do a love scene, and it goes too far. Actually, becomes real sex on the set, and instantly it goes viral. Somebody downloads it, steals it, and it goes viral. And it's what it does to James, to the marriage, to her career. And also just bringing in the dirtiness, the seediness, the obsession, you know, because I do click into the celebrity obsession, how people are just so obsessed with celebrities.
I don't get it, man. I don't get it. I do not understand how you can give $40 million over 3 years to those stupid-ass Kardashians, but okay,
right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, but that's what it is. It's like
I don't get
for,
it.
People are famous for doing nothing.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
really,
that's
basically it, you know?
Yeah, it's like have no talent, make millions of dollars.
That's it. And then also what happens here is like Facebook's on fire, Twitter's on fire, and it's just you go from one day being, say, like the Julia Roberts that everyone loves to the next day, all the negative stuff, you can't get away from the paparazzi, All of that. You know,
yeah.
Every time I see the paparazzi dogging somebody and just following them all the time, I was like, who wants to live like that?
I know.
I mean, just for me. I mean, the good thing about me, I'm a writer. I can actually go into a Barnes & Noble and sit down. Nobody recognizes me. If I'm having a book signing, they have my pictures up, yeah, they know who I am. But outside of that, I can walk in and sit down, and it's very, very peaceful. I just couldn't imagine everywhere I go, there's a camera, people jumping out of bushes. And also the character James Thicke, self-made man, and he has a temper. You know, the novel opens with him. He's going after the actor who slept with his wife.
Wow!
And, yeah.
So you started off, bam, right off the bat. Here you go.
Yeah, I mean it's right there. I mean it opens up with it would be the equivalent of seeing someone who is Brad Pitt getting beat to death in the rain on Sunset and La Brea in Hollywood, in front of everyone with cell phones. You know, and that's the world we live in now. Everyone has a cell phone, so everyone has a video.
Yeah.
You know, and then all of a sudden it just spirals out of control, and everyone's trying to do control what they can't control. You know, it's only so much publicity can do when everyone has videotape and post and repost and tweet and retweet and all the. It's amazing. People can say a lot of negative stuff. It doesn't have to be the truth, but if it's repeated enough, it becomes the truth.
Yeah.
It may not be your truth, but it becomes society's truth of how they see you. Yep. Just like something about someone just repeating it over and over, the same lie over and over again, you know?
Oh, yeah, also, that is so true.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, because you just keep saying it over and over, then, and you still get a lot of people who say, well, I read it on the Internet. It must have happened. You can't, anyone can post anything on the Internet.
Yeah.
You know, that's it.
Oh, yeah, the Internet must be true. It was on the Internet. Okay, whatever you guys believe, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and it, you know, and the novel, again, it's fast-paced action.
Yeah, you brought kind of all these things kind of into it, you know, a little modern stuff, little, you know, intrigue, affair, romance, killing.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of the whole nine yards and, you know, modernized it. It like you said, you know, with the fascination of why are people fascinated with TMZ, Eat Tonight and those kinds of stories, and
they
that's kind of what
up.
The whole thing is.
They eat them up. I mean, you're in a world now where if you're famous and you go to Eat, the moment you leave, they're going to run in and ask the waiter what you ate.
Oh, yeah, and then they'll post your damn receipt to show what you tipped.
Exactly. I mean, it's just ridiculous, you know. I mean, you look at the front of, and this is just my perspective, you know. And I think a lot of time as a writer, you have to step back and look at it and see it for just being as stupid as it is, you know. But
that's
it's
true.
The behavior of society. It's the behavior of society, you know.
Well, and a lot of your fans are probably like, Eric, I would recognize you if you were sitting out there and whatnot. Well, Lee Child one time said. You know, and Lee Child's written, you know, thousands, you know, sold millions and millions of books. He says, I've been recognized on the street one time by one guy.
Wow.
One guy
yeah.
in all his years recognized him when he was walking and said something to him. Otherwise, you won't know unless you're like at a voucher con or an event when you know that you're there.
Right.
And then you have your little name tag on and it says, you know, Eric Dickey.
Well, you know, because a lot of times, and then when you're doing a book signing, they have your pictures up.
Yeah,
so
they have your pictures up.
So people are looking for someone who looks like this photo.
Yeah, and then that could be a 10-year-old photo and you changed your hair.
Exactly. You know, and it's funny because, say if I'm doing an event, for me it's like going to work, I dress a certain kind of way, I dress a little bit nicer. You know, during the day I'm just bumming around, I'm just wearing sweats and T-shirt, wrinkled T-shirt, and if I'm out and about, nobody, I was actually at a biker show in Atlanta years ago with my girlfriend then, and... Mm-hmm. This girl who was working, they were selling jewelry and stuff like that. She looks at me and she says, "Has anyone ever told you that you look like Eric Jerome Dickey?" And I said, "I said a few times, you know." And she said, "But he wouldn't be here because, you know." And she just went on describing her perception of me. He would be wearing this, he would have on a Rolex, and I was like, okay, well, all right. Then she just turned around and walked away.
You never told her who you were?
Well, I couldn't possibly be him because I'm in beat up sweats and a wrinkled T-shirt, and she has this image of this guy who's always just totally blinged out.
Yeah.
I've never been blinged out a day in my life. <You know? laughs> But for her...
Fans are fickle, man. They are fickle. They want something in their mind, and that's what they want, and that's just all they are. I mean, they're hilarious. And you see them when you go to the events. When you go to the events, you can just see they're all rabid. It's cracked me up.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's that, you know, it's interesting because I'm on the fringes of Hollywood. I hear where I live. And a few weeks ago, I was down at the beach, and they were having the Grammys? Pre-Oscar party. They had it. It was down on the beach, and all the big name actors were just down there. So I'm walking by, and I'm just looking at. I was like, oh, that's so and so. That's and it was like no big deal. But 2 days later, when they have it down at the wherever they had it, it's total pandemonium.
which beach were they at?
Santa Monica Beach. I went down.
They were down
in
Santa Monica. Okay.
Santa Monica, yeah, because I went to this place called Raw Volutions. I eat a lot of raw foods, and I had lunch, and then I walked. I was two blocks from the beach, so I walked over. I'm just casually walking, and all of a sudden, there's a fence, and not even real security, but some guys standing there, and then inside, everyone's in suits, and they're doing junkets, and Howard is going by, the guy on the TV show Awake is, and they're like 10 feet from me. I'm like, wow. Huh. You know, but, that madness wasn't there. I mean, they have an event. Everyone is there, and there was no madness. But 2 days later, when they have it at the event with all the hype,
yeah,
all the pandemonium is there.
I know, and that's the funny thing too, is because you know we're in Southern California. You're
right.
In Southern California, and we just never seem to hook up. And you know, you were at the LA Times Book Festival. I think we had something going on that weekend. We couldn't make it.
Oh yeah,
and,
it was really nice too. It was really nice.
Yeah, well, it was the USC, which is we went last year, and I don't know. I mean, it seemed like it was a little bit nicer than it was at the UCLA. It wasn't quite so spread out, and USC is a little easier campus to get around.
UCLA.
People have never been. They got to go. So you got to go see it once in your life. You got to go do that.
Even there at the book event, there are a lot of celebrities. John Cusack. They're just there walking around.
Yeah, I mean,
they're just there walking around. You know, just
and you might
know.
Not recognize them. You might have no idea. You know, we saw Luke Perry at the Nick Santora for his book launching over at the Grove.
Right,
I didn't know
right.
who the hell he was. I didn't know who he was until someone pointed him out, and I'm like, oh, that is Luke Perry. Now I can see it. But the guy had the beard, and he's a little older. He's like, he doesn't look like he does on the show.
Well, and the thing, and the Grove is one of those places where
they're all over. Always.
Well, you know, because a lot of people who work in the business, they go shopping like everybody else. They go to bookstores. They go to eat, you know. And there's been a lot of times I've been in the Grove. I mean, I've seen Halle Berry just walk by, just walk out of store and walk by. Paparazzi's not with her. They're not chasing her down. She's just out.
Because
it's me. I'm at a La Cienega again third, and I pull up at a light, and Morgan Freeman pulls up the light next to me.
Yeah. Oh, really?
You're like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
I was in a restaurant about to walk out, and it's so funny. I walk right into Sidney Poitier. And there was this moment where I was like, I know this guy. Then I thought, oh, I don't know him. Well, he doesn't know me, you know. So I just said, hi, how you doing? He said, hi, we shook hands, and he went left, I went right, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like people out that are not in Hollywood and not in Southern California literally think like Robert Pattinson dresses like Edward, and that's who you're going to see on the street. Okay. He does not dress like that. That's just his character.
That's just his makeup.
But
yeah.
He probably has something totally different. And it's almost like almost 85% of the people that Hollywood stars that you're going to meet, when you meet them, it's going to blow you away with how they actually are. And you're like, oh, that's what they're like?
Yeah.
They're totally different. They don't have that aura. They don't have that, you know, thing going on.
They're
not followed by a god or an angel. They're just people.
They're just people, man. And I think, because someone has said... there's something about it's the biggest letdown for many is to meet the person that they admire. So just admire them from afar.
Yeah. Just leave the stigmata that way. Leave it afar.
Leave it afar. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, because at the end of the day, we're some people are just more fortunate, but you know, like you say, like Rob, he's probably has a stylist now, and people become more aware of that. Every time I step out, there might be somebody with a camera. So now, you know, just think of the women who are just totally paranoid. And Regina Baptiste has some of this too in the novel, An Accidental Affair. You're just afraid to step out because someone may take a photo of you without makeup on. It goes
and then
viral.
Guess what? Then it's on the National Enquirer, and
it's
then your whole big story of here's photos of people without makeup, and you know, and you never want to be the person, the National Enquirer, where they show just the body and they etch out the face and they say, guess who this is? You're like, oh my God, I don't want. Oh shit.
You know, and when I was writing the book, I was really trying to get into all of that, as much of that as I can, within maintaining the pace of the suspense, and there's mystery in there as well, and romance. But I was trying to get into as much of that as I could. I have so many RSS feeds in there. Well enough to support the story. Just how, you know, how we get the minute. All the news is like everything happened 10 seconds ago. You know, 2 minutes ago. You know what I mean? So and also we're in a society now where people post something. The way what makes them feel good is the number of people who like it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like I posted something. This many people liked it. I have attention, you know, getting into that, you know. And then also, for every situation that's really tragic or you just don't want to share with the world. There's a comic who's taking advantage of it. I even have a comic in here who's just totally just ripping the whole situation through the whole book. And for the when it's happening to you, it's just not funny. But to have something that just totally rocked your world, it's on Leno, Letterman, Kimmel, all the political shows are doing jokes about it. It's devastating, you know, and trying to tap into that, you know.
I know. Well, I just
couldn't imagine being that person. I mean, you know, because for years, I was just thinking, for years. All the fat jokes about Elizabeth Taylor, all the Michael Jackson jokes, all the just somebody becomes the butt of the joke of the year, and they just beat them up. You know what I mean?
Because they're
easy targets, they're easy punchlines, they're easy laughs.
Exactly.
You know.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you so much for coming on. We have run out of time, and it is always a pleasure to have you. The book is An Accidental Affair, ericjeromedickey.com. And, Eric, you know, anytime that you want to talk to us or come on or whatnot, just email me. Hopefully you still get the magazine in your email. If you don't, email me so I have your address so you can get it all the time.
Okay, don't.
Because you're in this issue, so I want to make sure that you get it. So just email me at editor@suspensemagazine.com, and I'll send it over right away. But
okay,
I want to thank you so much for coming on.
And thanks for having me on again, man. It's great talking to you, as usual.
Yes, you have a good one, Eric, and enjoy yourself.
Okay, you too.
All right, bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that was Eric Jerome Dickey. The book is An Accidental Affair. His website, ericjeromedickey.com. Find out more information about everything that he's doing and, you know, keep in touch with him. We are going to be right back here with our last guest of the show, Cindy Cromer. And right now we were going to have an audio clip, and I just happened to notice by John Baylor we're going to play Death Dealt the Hand. Unfortunately, it seemed like the clip didn't load correctly. So we're going to have it on at the next show at a later date. But right now, listen to this, and we'll be right back in a couple minutes.
we are back, everybody, here. We want to thank everybody so much for joining us, staying with us for the last hour and a half. Our last segment here is coming up, where we are going to have author Cindy Cromer on the show. I want to thank everybody who has been on, and everybody, of course, who helps contribute to the show and the magazine and everything. You know who you are. I'm not going to list everything. This is not Oscar speech. But, again, N. William Phelps, author of many different books and the host of Dark Minds on ID Channel, was our first guest. DJ Nico with her book, The Tenth Saint. And then we just had Eric Jerome Dickey with An Accidental Affair. But right now, our last guest coming up, author of the book Desperate Measures. You can find her out. Now, her website is it's CindyHefnerCromer.com, but that's HefnerCromer.com. And the book is Desperate Measures. So, Cindy, how are you doing? And thanks so much for coming on.
I'm doing great, John, and thank you so much for having me.
Hey, so your debut novel, Desperate Measures, available. You have it here. It's on eTreasuresPublishing.com, along with Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and some other places.
Yes.
Tell everybody a little bit about Desperate Measures, about the book, and a little behind-the-scenes action you have going on there.
It's, well, it's set, the main setting is the Caribbean island of St. Kitts. The main character, Caitlin Martell, it starts out with her going to her office and getting a cryptic message warning her against DNA testing. She assumes it's related to her company and this brilliant research scientist she just had hired. The book then, once they get to St. Kitts, another threat is left, and it brings back a memory, a flashback of 16 years ago, and she realizes it may be tied into a family secret that her father revealed to her. When her father, Jack Spencer, told her he was adopted and his father could be a multi-billionaire, there are things he kept hidden and didn't tell her everything. That's what thrusts her into this plot, because she receives more threats. And the FBI has brought in, her husband is an FBI agent, a senior FBI agent. And There are things that are revealed that he knows about her that she doesn't even know, that came out in his background check for the FBI when they got married. Each character is introduced and has little bits and pieces of the secret that ties everything together in a climatic conclusion, where there's an alliance between two dangerous enemies that concludes the plot.
Now, seeing as this has, you know, this is your debut book,
yes,
and, you know, how long did it take you to kind of, you know, get the book going? I mean, I always kind of ask this, especially with debut books, is did you kind of decide on the plot? Did you have the characters first? What came first in your mind for you to be able to start creating, you know, this book here, Desperate Measures?
How I started Desperate Measures was I created Caitlin and gave her a background similar to mine as an executive and scientist. And then I thought of a book that I'd like to read with DNA, a little bit of science, not too much science to overwhelm the reader, with acronyms, and a suspicious plot of family secrets. And as I started writing it, my second book, Desperate Deception, started to form. And I thought, wow, oh my gosh, if this book ever gets published, it would be a miracle. But the second book had already started to form during the plot of Desperate Measures.
And, you know, which happens, because I know just from, like, my writing and doing different things, and all of a sudden you're not even finished with something, and something else already pops into your head of, oh, God, I can kind of explore this later, or kind of do those things later. So I definitely understand, and I think a lot of authors understand kind of how, you know, those things kind of happen. And when you were writing the book, did you have your, you know, was this something that you were going to leave into a series? Did you know that your characters were not, you know, you were going to have a standalone? How is it going to work in the future with your writing?
Well, that's an excellent question, John, and thank you so much for asking me that. at the onset, I had initially intended for Desperate Deceptions to be another book, a standalone, where someone could pick it up and read it without having to read Desperate Measures, but of course propel the sales for, you know, my first book. When I started writing Desperate Deceptions, I struggled in not recreating Desperate Measures and recreating and, you know, and creating Desperate Deceptions as its own plot. So it's a mix. It's
okay.
It's a standalone, but it would be better if the reader read Desperate Measures first. But they won't be confused if they read.
There's going to be some continuation character wise and things in the second book, but enough to where if somebody, you know, you definitely want people to kind of read it maybe in order, but if they didn't, it wouldn't be that big of a thing that they didn't have to do, I guess.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, so you kind of thought about that, which is good, because I think that some authors, you know, and you're kind of almost ahead of the times by thinking of that and thinking of your fans on how those things are going to do. I mean, that's something that, you know, should be commended, because some authors might not, you know, don't think that way.
Right. So after this one, I'm taking a break and I'm writing a completely different book. I've got drafted out. Different characters. I need a break from these characters for a bit. But I do want to get back to some characters that I created in Desperate Measures and give them their own plot. Tomas Medina, for one, and Barry Salerno. I think I could come up with a great plot and background for them with their own story as the protagonist.
And, you know, since you are kind of, you are debut author, you're kind of new out to the scene and things like that, it's also very exciting when certain things come your way. And you had something exciting because you were selected to be the keynote speaker coming up here on May 20th for an event. How did that shape up? And kind of like what exactly are you going to be doing?
Yes, I'm thrilled with this. This came out of the blue. I'm going to be the keynote speaker at the Ballantine Writers Forum in Charlotte, North Carolina on May 20th. And this came about through Facebook, if you can believe it.
Facebook, something actually good comes out of Facebook.
Yeah. And this is through a high school friend of mine which is actually a funny story. Her and I were friends, and we knew each other. We weren't she played soccer, I played basketball. Our paths didn't really connect in high school. We knew of each other, but that was about it. She ended up studying molecular physiology and became a PhD. I ended up in chemistry and biology, and now our paths crossed through writing. And she's part of this writer's forum in North Carolina and has invited me to be organized for me to be the keynote speaker, which I'm thrilled about. I went to Mystery Martyrs of America conference, Sleuthfest, in March, and Jeffrey Deaver was the keynote speaker. So
yeah, he's a great guy. I know Jeffrey. He's a great guy.
Yep. So this is exciting for me that of this caliber has come about.
I mean, to come out of the box, I mean, debut author, and to come out of the box to be able to do something like this is extremely exciting. There's been authors that have been doing this for many, many, many years and haven't had the opportunity that you've had. So, yeah, it's something that you definitely got to be extremely excited about, and that's just a great accomplishment to be able to do this.
Yes, I'm thrilled.
Yeah. And you can hear it in your voice when you said, I'm thrilled to do this. And you're just like that. You know, that's just kind of the excitement and enthusiasm that, you know, is definitely brought out. And that's probably, you know, what, you know, when you're writing about, you know, you're keeping all those kinds of emotions as a person. And you're kind of putting yourself on the page, which is something that, you know, your fans like to know. Because fans like to know not only about the plot, but about who you are as an author, to kind of maybe be able to relate to you or just be able to get your story of how you kind of came about doing everything.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
Go ahead.
As an avid reader, I'm probably the only nerd geek in the world who picks up a book the cover will draw me in. I'll read the back synopsis, but I always go to read about the author. If I haven't heard about this author before, I always read their bio, because their background is interesting to me. So that draws me in quite a bit to reading books as a reader. So
yep.
I'm hoping I draw my readers into my with my background with science, but not overwhelming everyone with acronyms and such, as I mentioned before.
But what that does is it brings the believability that they know that when you're writing about this, that the fans know that it's true, and this is kind of how it actually is. Even if it's boring, or even if it's, you know, whatever it is, they know that it's legitimate, instead of just like, oh, this just sounds made up. The legitimacy in the writing is what is also extremely important, and with your background, that's what you're able to give, and that's what you're able to do, and that's extremely important.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, you talked about what you got going on or what you got coming up in the future, but just as kind of like an off the subject kind of fun question here, what is one book that you wish you would have written? Any book in the world, any book ever, what book do you wish that you would have written?
Okay, this is an excellent question. There are many. I've read so many books. But one book that stands out in my mind as an author now, and I remember as a reader way back, The Perfect Husband by Lisa Gardner. I can remember that book to this day, and getting to the end and saying, wow, I did not see that coming.
I will have to tell Lisa next time I talk with her that that you're one of her biggest fans.
Yeah. Well, hopefully not the biggest fan like James Caan had in the Misery movie, but...
Well, yeah.
No, she has a knack, and when I started writing Desperate Measures, I had that in my mind, that I was going to write a book with an ending that nobody could see coming. And from the comments I've gotten and the questions I've gotten, I think I have accomplished that, because I haven't gotten one person who's contacted me yet with the correct answer until the very end, the correct answer of the identity and motive of the villain. So I'm very proud of myself for that fact. If I could create a book along the lines of hers.
So, and have you met Lisa? Have you been able to talk with her? Did you email her? Like maybe through her page about your book and see if she would read it and give you a blurb or anything kind of like that?
I've emailed her, but she's busy, and of course I haven't heard back, but yes, I have.
Yeah.
I've emailed her and, you know, communicated with her on Facebook.
Oh, but, you have? So you have talked with her before?
Not personally, no.
Oh, okay.
She's a doll.
When you see her, I mean, she is. It's one of those, you know, like we just talked with Eric Jerome Dickey, and he was saying that sometimes it's not that good to meet your, you know, like an idol, because they just never turn out to be that way. But Lisa is just cute as a button, extremely nice, loves, you know, when people come up and talk to her about her work and everything else, and just so personable and down to earth. It's fascinating. She's definitely not in that mold of somebody that you're like would be disappointed.
Right.
Yeah. And now,
well, that she's
you
my
have,
goal, my idol. I hope to reach her status one day where someone just sees my name on a book and buys it, regardless of the cover or anything.
And now, do you have any plans of, you know, we know you're going to the Ballantine thing, but what other plans do you have to kind of go out there and start your, you know, forging your own path with your fans and letting them meet you, whether, you know, in book signings and, you know, like a Boucher Con or Thriller Fest and places like that?
Well, Mystery Writers of America, I'm a member of them. Thriller Fest, I've seen your ad for that. I haven't signed up for that yet. I'm thinking about it. But I just hard at work at finishing the second book right now. I might attend the Romance of America conference in Anaheim in July. I think it's coming up in July.
Yeah, RWA.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Even though my book is, I it should be pure mystery based on the classification of the genre. As you know, how everybody gets agents and publishers get into that genre. It's, in my opinion, it's strictly mystery, but it's classified as a romantic suspense because it has the family ties and the relationship from the past and the secret. So it does qualify as a romance as well.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of events and a lot of things, and I don't know if you've done a lot of blog tours or a lot of places out there like that. Are people able to maybe mail you books, get them signed, and things of that nature?
Yes, I just signed up for KindleGraph. So anybody who has a Kindle.
And so now explain that. What exactly is that?
It's I can electronically sign anybody who's purchased my book on Kindle.
Okay.
They don't even have to purchase it, and I can send them an electronic signature with a personalized note. I haven't done one yet, so don't ask me too many technical questions about that.
Okay.
But it's exciting.
So this is something new, and how did you find this out? I mean,
my publisher sent me the link to set it up.
Oh, okay. So now you're starting to get into a little bit more of the technical understanding this whole crazy author marketing stuff out there now, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah, and now that's another question that, you know, we like to kind of get into with debut authors is, you know, you wrote the book, you spent a lot of time writing it, putting it together, getting it out there, you finally get it out and get it done, and you kind of brush your hair back, and you're like, phew, I finally did it. And then you realize that your work has only just begun.
Oh, just
by
begun,
having
yes.
to market. How's that road been?
Every author will tell you this. The writing the book is the easy part. The promoting it and getting your name out there, especially for a new author, is the hard part. I mean, I like doing publicity. I like talking. I like speaking. I can talk to anybody. If I'm in a store, if I see somebody, you know, here's my bookmark, read this book. But it is hard. You have to.
Yeah.
There are so many websites out there, and at Mystery Writers of America, this topic came up in every seminar. Authors are expected to do more and more publicity, so, you know, with all the cutbacks, and publishers are doing less, and so are agents. And just throw something at whatever you find, and whatever sticks, go with it. Because LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, I mean, everything up there. It's impossible to keep up with all of them. It's impossible to keep up with all the avenues and websites. In March, I was the Romance Reviews had a big contest, and this was a lot of fun. They did something unique, and I signed up for this with a book giveaway. So a winner won a signed copy of my book. They had questions that pertinent to the plot. Each author had to submit questions pertinent to each plot, and I submitted some questions with a five-chapter preview to draw everyone in to, you know, read the first five chapters and answer the questions correctly, and then whoever won a signed copy. So that was unique. That was very unique, things like that. I'm on Just Romantic Suspense. I'm advertising on that, and I was the featured author on April 13th, and I wrote up something different, a character interview, which I received a lot of feedback on. And it was a fictitious interview with Lucas Buckland, who's the protagonist in my book, the multi-billionaire, possible grandfather of Caitlin Martell, the main character. I love the way I wrote the interview because it really portrayed his true personality and what he's about in the book and how he operates, what he does, how he does things. So,
yeah.
That was exciting.
I mean, absolutely. So I'll tell you what. I mean, Cindy, you're doing all the right things. You've done all the things that you need to do to be successful, and you should be, you know, applauded for that, because too many authors are just not getting it and just don't understand the kind of work and dedication it takes that goes into. And like I said, after you write the end, it's really only the beginning. It might be the end for the fans, but it's only the beginning for the author. And that's something that you should be commended for. And I just, you know, hope that you just keep going and that you just keep everything up because, you know, you're starting on the right path. You know, you've written a very intriguing book that a lot of fans should, you know, go pick up and read. You can, you know, they can download it right away. And, I, you know, we wish you nothing but success in the future. We want to just thank you so much for, you know, coming on.
Well, thank you, John. And this has been exciting for me speaking with you.
Oh,
and,
you're welcome. Yes. We appreciate it.
And, you know, this is a great opportunity. And, yes, I'm going to persevere. And
absolutely. Just keep going through. I mean, I know that it seems that you are the little guppy in the ocean, but eventually the guppy does grow if the guppy eats enough. So you just have to get out there. And I don't know what the hell that means. But I'm just saying that this is kind of like my analogy is, you know, the little guppy, when they keep eating and they keep getting bigger and bigger, eventually, you know, you get to the status that maybe that's your, you know, where the goal is that you're shooting for.
Exactly. And James Patterson started one day as a little guppy, right?
They all did. Stephen King almost threw his Carrie novel in the trash, saying, "I'm never going to write again." It was his wife that pulled it out and sent it to the publisher because he couldn't handle the rejections anymore. So look where he is too. And I know,
oh, well, the rejections,
you know, King Coon's
that's
the same
another
way.
Thing. The rejections in this process, they didn't bother me at all. I knew going into this I was going to get rejections, 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 because you can't be an author without, or you can't be a writer and strive to be an author without getting rejections. And
right.
That is a hard part, but that didn't bother me one bit. I mean, some authors, some agents sent back nice rejections, others were the form rejections. Others had some constructive criticism, and those were the ones that I took and ran with them and embraced and redid my work and polished it and then sent it off to the next and probably to them same ones again. So that is a big part of this process, rejection.
Yeah, well, just keep going through, and again, we want to thank you so much for coming on, and we wish you nothing but the best in the future, and keep us up to date on what's happening.
I will. Thank you, John. Have a great weekend.
All right, bye-bye. You too. Have a good one.
Bye.
Okay, everybody, again, that was author Cindy Cromer, and that was talking about her her latest book, Desperate Measures, and you can find her on her website. Now, you might have to write this down because it's a little, you know, a little longer. It's Cindy, and it's HUEFNERCromer.com to find out more information, HUEFNER. And then it's CROMER.com to find out more information about what she's doing. Well, it's been a very, very, very exciting show. And I want to, again, thank all of our guests that were on the show today, starting with M. William Phelps, host of Dark Minds on the ID channel, author extraordinaire, on to DJ Nico and her book, The Tenth Saint, then Eric Jerome Dickey, and The Accidental Affair, coming up here now with Cindy Cromer and her book, Desperate Measures. We'll be back next week with a power-packed show of authors Steve Barry, Nick Santora, and Paul Kepadouris, who you might know from the Pneuma Files and writing with Clive Cussler, and they'll all be joining with us about all their books. So we will see you again next week, next Saturday at 10 o'clock. I'm your host, John Roth. This is Suspense Radio. Join us at suspensemagazine.com for all the news and everything that's going on with the magazine. The May issue is out. Again, we will see you all next Saturday. Have a good weekend and enjoy it. Thanks, everybody.